movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Matt Jensen 8, The Eyes of Texas. Narrated by Dylan Lynch, with performances by Thomas Penny, Bradley Smith, Tracy Lynn Oliveira, Evan Casey, Thomas Keegan, Richard Cutting, Jonathan Watkins, Michael Glenn, Tim Carlin, Patrick Bussing, James Konacek, Tim Getman, James Lewis, David Coyne, Gregory Gorton, Christopher Graybill, Nick DePinto, Danny Gavigan, Terrence Azelford, Matthew McGee, David Jordan, Jeff Allen, Eric Messner, Joe Brack, Stephen Carpenter, Matthew Bassett, Michael John Casey, Lily Beacon, Reagan Wilson, Mark Halpern, Colleen Delaney, Ken Jackson, Nora Schrade, Yasmin Toison, Elizabeth Jernigan, Mort Shelby, Scott McCormick, and Richard Rohn. The Bird Ranch, Las Animas County, Colorado. Matt Jensen was coming back from town with gifts for Eamon Bird and his wife, Bernice. Eamon Bird was one of Matt's oldest friends, and for a while, the two of them had been residents of the Soda Creek Home for Wayward Boys and Girls, an orphanage of sorts. The gifts, a decorative blue and white vase for Bernice and a sheepskin coat for Eamon, were thanks for them having given Matt a place to stay for a while. Matt Jensen was a man who wandered around, always ready to go to the next town to see the elephant. Although he was never totally dissatisfied with where he was or with what he was doing, he was always happy as saying goodbye with someplace else to go. Matt always wondered what was beyond the next line of hills just over the horizon. He traveled light with a bowie knife, a .44 double-action Colt, a Winchester .44-40 rifle, a rain slicker, an overcoat, two blankets, two spare shirts, socks, two extra pairs of trousers, and extra underwear. Because he was a wanderer, he often dropped in on old friends, though never without contacting them first and never without leaving them with a gift of thanks. Dismounting in front of the house, Matt very carefully removed the vase, then wrapped it up in the sheepskin coat and went inside.
Eamon! Eamon, where are you?
Matt!
Eamon, where are you?
In the kitchen.
Matt pulled his pistol and went cautiously into the kitchen. The first thing he saw was the naked body of Bernice Bird. She was lying on the floor in a pool of her own blood.
No. Eamon!
Over here.
Eamon was on the other side of the wood-burning cooking range. He was sitting up, leaning back against the wall, holding his hands over his stomach. His hands were covered with blood, as was the front of his shirt and the top part of his pants.
My God, Eamon, what happened?
Matt quickly put away his pistol, then kneeled beside his friend to see what he could do to help him. When he pulled Eamon's hand away from the wound, he saw his friend's intestines hanging out.
Bernice?
Matt didn't know if he should tell him or not, but he knew that his friend wasn't going to make it, and he figured he had a right to know the truth. He shook his head.
I'm sorry, Eamon. She didn't make it.
I thought as much. I kept calling out to her, but she never answered. I'll see her in a few more minutes anyway. 'Cause I'm not going to make it either.
Who did this, Eamon?
I don't know. I never saw them before. There was two of them. Rode up, said they was hungry, and asked if we could give them anything to eat. Bernice invited them into the kitchen, and one of them took a knife to me. I must have passed out, because next thing I knew, they were gone, and I couldn't get Bernice to answer me.
You say there were two of them. Can you describe them?
One of them was kind of short and stocky. He had a real bad scar come down across his left eye. His hair was kind of red. The other fellow called him Mutt. The other man was tall, with long, dark hair, beard, and a mustache. I never heard his name said, though.
Did you see which way they went?
I didn't see him, but I heard them. They was going south when they left here.
Matt walked to the front of the house and saw tracks of two horses heading south. One of them was riding a horse with a tie bar shoe. Smiling at his luck, Matt went back inside.
We're in luck, Eamon. One of them's riding a... Damn.
His friend was dead.
I'll find them for you, Eamon. I promise you, they will not get away with this.
After Matt covered the nude body of Bernice, Matt rode into Trinidad, the county seat of Las Animas County, and reported the murders to the sheriff.
My God. Both of them?
Both of them. And I'd better warn you, Sheriff, it's not a pretty sight.
I'll go have a look around.
I've got a lead on who did it. I want you to deputize me so it'll be legal when I bring them back.
Sheriff Carson pulled a badge from his desk drawer and pinned it on Matt.
Raise your right hand. You swear to do a good job?
I do.
You're deputized. I guess from what you tell me that I should take Tom Nunnally with me to bring the bodies back.
That would be a good idea.
Mutt Crowley lay on top of a flat rock looking back along the trail over which they had just come.
Is he still there?
Yeah, still there.
Who is it that's a-trailing us, Mutt?
How the hell am I supposed to know Coy? I ain't seen him close enough to identify even if I did know him.
Crowley rubbed the scar on his eyelid, a habit he had acquired since he picked up the scar in a knife fight with a Mexican 3 years ago.
Well, I'll say this for him. Once he gets his teeth into you, he don't give up. We've tried every trick in the book to shake him off our trail, but he's still there.
What are we gonna do about that sidewinder? Can't shake him off.
Coy Ashford looked back toward the rider.
All right, let's go up through that draw.
That's a dead-end canyon.
Yeah, I know it's a dead-end canyon, but it's got two or three good places in there where we can hide. And all we gotta do is let him follow us in there, then ambush him.
What if he don't come in? What if he just stays back at the mouth of the canyon and waits us out?
The way this fellow's been dogging us, I don't think he'll wait for nothing. If he knows we're in there, he'll come after us. That gives us the edge.
Yeah, well, maybe you're right. Best thing to do with someone like that is to lie in ambush and kill him. Let's just do it and get it over with.
Come on, I know the perfect spot.
When Matt trailed the two men into the canyon, he pulled his long gun out of the saddle holster, then dismounted and started walking into the canyon leading Spirit. The canyon made a 45-degree turn to the left just in front of him, so Matt stopped. Right before he got to the turn, he slapped Spirit on the rump and sent him through. Crowley and Ashford opened up on what they thought would be their pursuer. Instead, their bullets whizzed harmlessly over the empty saddle of the riderless horse. From his position just around the corner from the turn, Matt was able to locate them. They were on the south side of the canyon, squeezed in between the wall itself and a rock outcropping that provided them with a natural cover. Matt studied the rock face of the wall just behind the spot where he had located them. Then he took aim with his rifle. Matt wasn't even trying to aim at the two men, but was instead firing at the rock wall behind them, knowing that even if the ricocheting bullets didn't kill them, they would make things awfully uncomfortable for them. He emptied his rifle, then he began reloading.
Mister! Mister!
What do you want?
My pard's been killed. I want to give up.
All right, come on down with your hands up.
A man moved out from behind the rock and started toward him.
Drop your gun and put both hands up.
The man did as Matt ordered, then continued toward him, holding both hands over his head. From his size and the very obvious scar on his face, Matt knew that this was the one Eamon had said was Mutt. Matt, with his own pistol in hand, started toward him.
Now, Mutt!
Mutt Crowley threw himself to the ground. Coy Ashford stepped out from behind the rock outcropping and fired. Matt shot crumpled Ashford to the ground with a bleeding hole in his chest. Matt quickly walked over to the body. Satisfied that the would-be ambusher was dead, he turned back toward the other man who was still holding his hands in the air.
What's your name?
Crowley. Mutt Crowley. Is Ashford dead?
Yes, he's dead.
He's the one that done it. All I wanted to do was steal a little money and go on. But Ashford, I don't know, he went crazy. First he cut the rancher's gut open, and then he cut the woman's throat. He done it all. I didn't have nothing to do with it.
Matt looked down at the body.
Where's the knife? Or did he borrow yours?
He pointed to the hunting knife hanging from Crowley's belt.
I ain't gonna talk no more.
I don't want you to talk. I want you to run.
What? What do you mean you want me to run?
I want you to run, Crowley. Please, try to run away from me.
You're crazy. I ain't running and I ain't fighting back. You gotta take me in alive.
All right. I guess I'd rather see you hang anyway.
Trinidad, Colorado. At Mutt Crowley's trial, Matt's testimony was damning. He told how he had found Eamon and Bernice Byrd, that Eamon had still been alive and had given a physical description of his killers. He told also how he had tracked the two men from the Byrd Ranch to Three Dog Canyon, where he'd engaged in a shootout with them, killing Coy Ashford and placing Mutt Crowley under arrest. Mutt Crowley did not deny being there, but he tried, unsuccessfully, to blame everything on Ashford. It was now time for the prosecutor to wrap up the case.
There is no question but that Mutt Crowley was at the Byrd Ranch. In his dying declaration, Eamon Byrd gave a vivid and accurate description of the animals who attacked him and then raped and murdered his wife. Mr. Matt Jensen, a man who is well known throughout the West for his tracking ability, honesty, and integrity, and being legally empowered to do so, tracked Mutt Crowley and Coy Ashford from the Byrd Ranch until he located them at Three Dog Canyon. There, in a deadly gunfight, he killed Coy Ashford and brought Crowley back to stand trial.
The prosecutor turned toward Crowley, who was sitting defiantly at the defendant's table.
And Crowley admits to being there. He claims that it was Ashford who killed Mr. and Mrs. Byrd, even though both were killed with a knife. And Crowley was the only one of the two men who had a knife. Also, Crowley's clothes were covered with blood when he was brought in, but Crowley had not been wounded. And Coy Ashford suffered only the single shot that killed him. Where did the blood that was on Crowley's clothes come from? It's very clear that the blood that was on him came from Eamon and Bernice Byrd. Despite Crowley's claim that it was Coy Ashford who did the actual killing, it is clear from the evidence presented during the course of this trial that Mutt Crowley was the murderer. But the prosecution is willing to drop that part of the assertion. We are willing to say that it might have been Ashford and not Crowley who wielded the knife that ended the lives of two of this county's most revered citizens.
The prosecutor looked back toward Crowley.
Mr. Crowley, if you say you didn't do it, we will accept that.
A big grin spread across Crowley's face, and he nodded triumphantly.
Evidently, Mr. Crowley does not understand the law. We don't have to prove that he is the one who killed Mr. and Mrs. Byrd. All we have to do is prove that he was there. The Colorado Penal Code allows that a person can be convicted of any felony, including capital murder, as a party to the offense. As a party means that the person did not personally commit the elements of the crime, but is otherwise responsible for the conduct of the actual perpetrator as defined by law, to include encouraging its commission, or being present and making no effort to stop it, or, following such commission, failing to report the crime. Therefore, by association and by his own admission, Mutt Crowley is guilty of murder and should face the hangman's rope.
Order! I will have order!
At the conclusion of the summation, the judge charged the jury, then sent them back to the jury room for deliberation. Less than 15 minutes later, everyone was quietly waiting for the jury's decision. Judge Murchison was a dominating figure with brindled hair, a square jaw, and piercing blue eyes who, by appearance and demeanor, could immediately make his presence known.
Gentlemen of the jury, have you selected a foreman?
We have, Your Honor. My name is Frank Tanner, and I have been selected as foreman.
Mr. Tanner, has the jury reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
Then if you would, please, publish the verdict.
Your Honor, we, the people of this legally selected and appointed jury, find the defendant, Mutt Crowley, guilty of murder in the first degree.
So say you one, so say you all. Let me hear from the jury by the word Aye.
Aye.
Are there any in opposition? Very well. Mr. Defense Attorney, please bring the prisoner to stand before the bench.
The prisoner was brought before the bench and he stared defiantly at the judge.
Do whatever you're gonna do, you son of a bitch. Just don't keep me standing here for all the peckerwoods to gawk at.
Oh, I will, sir. Believe me, I will. Mutt Crowley, tonight the sun will set and spread the western sky in brilliant hues of scarlet and gold until, finally, it sinks below the horizon. But you, Mutt Crowley, will not see it. At the break of dawn tomorrow, the sun will reach into the canyons and draws to push away the last remnants of the purple haze. There will be in the air the delightful scent of pine needles to perfume the new day. But, Mutt Crowley, this will be of no concern to you. You will not be here because I hereby order the sheriff of Los Animas County to lead you to the gallows and there to hang you by the neck until you are dead. Afterward, your body will then be taken down and buried so that it becomes food for the maggots. But you won't even be there for that, because by then your condemned soul will have left your body and it will be writhing in the eternal torment of hell. Sheriff, get this worthless remnant of humanity out of my sight.
Although the trial, verdict, and execution were scheduled to happen on the same day, so sure had everyone been that Crowley would be found guilty and sentenced to hang that visitors had come from miles around to watch him dance in the air. As a result, there were a lot of strange faces in the town, most of them gathered on the square. The gallows stood in the center of town, its grisly shadow stretching under the afternoon sun. The hanging was not to be until 5, and it was now only 3:30. But the crowd was already thick and jostling for position. Murchison had specifically chosen the time of the hanging so the people would be able to watch it after they got off work, then talk over their dinner about justice being done. Several hundred people were gathered around the gallows, men in suits, shirt sleeves and overalls, women in long dresses and bonnets. Children, who didn't quite understand the significance of the event, were there as well. The younger ones stood silently, grasping the hands of their mothers. A couple of older boys approached the cell and tried to peer in through the window, but a woman called out to them and they returned to the crowd. A photographer paid a farmer $2 to allow him to set up his camera tripod in the bed of the farmer's wagon, and he was there now, sighting through the camera to get the picture set up just right. Inside the jail, Crowley didn't roll over to see who was unlocking the door.
Go away. I got at least half an hour left. I don't plan to go out there and stand in front of all those folks any longer than I have to.
Of course, you can stay here if you wish, but I would think you might be ready to leave about now.
What?
Looking toward the cell door, Crowley saw that it was wide open, and his brother was standing there with a big smile on his face.
Pritchard, what are you doing here?
It was brought to my attention that you had gotten yourself into a bit of trouble, so it became incumbent upon me, as your older brother and guardian, to come over and see what I could do to extricate you from the situation.
A jailer and a deputy?
You needn't concern yourself about them.
Really?
We had best hurry. If someone should see them in their present state, they're likely to get a little suspicious.
You got horses?
They're out back.
A few moments later, the men were mounted on the horses and were riding away slowly, their hats pulled low.
Hey, you two boys ain't leaving now, are you? Don't you want to see the hanging?
No, thank you. I find hangings to be brutal and inhumane.
The two men continued their slow ride out of town. 1 year later, Shady Rest, Texas, the Ace High Saloon.
By God, boy,
I paid to have this woman sit by me, and if you don't get up and go to another table, I'll kill you right where you're sitting.
There are at least 24 people in the saloon, counting the bartender and the 4 bar girls. At the moment, all eyes were directed toward the table where Ethan Scarns, a bar girl, and a cowboy named Moore were sitting.
You paid for a drink. You didn't pay for the woman.
Ethan Scarns was a small, gnarled-looking man. In a world without guns, he would barely draw a second look. But this was a world with guns. And Scarns was a perfect example of the saying, God made man, but Sam Colt made them equal.
Now, did you hear what I said, Moore?
Slowly and deliberately, Scarns pulled his pistol and pointed it at Moore.
I told you to move to another table.
I like this table.
Move, or so help me, I'll blow your brains out.
You're crazy. You're both crazy.
The bar girl started to get up. Scarns pulled her back down in the chair.
You ain't going nowhere. I bought you.
You bought a drink. You didn't buy me.
Well, it's the same thing.
Leave the girl be, Scarns.
Now you just stay the hell out of this, Reese. This ain't no concern for a bartender.
Scarns looked back toward Moore.
I thought I told you to get.
I ain't going nowhere.
Scarns cocked his gun.
I ain't asking you again. I'm going to count to 3, and if you ain't out of that chair by the time I get to 3, I'm going to blow your head off. 1.
This ain't going to turn out good for you.
What the hell are you talking about? 2.
When Moore lifted his right hand from under the table, his fingers were curled around a Colt 44. Scarns looked down in surprise at the hole the bullet had just punched in the middle of his chest. Scarns dropped his gun and put his hand over the wound.
Oh, you killed me.
Yeah, I did. Are you upset that I didn't wait until you got the 3?
What happened here?
Red Gimlin came into the main room from his office in the back. Gimlin, whose once red hair had turned white, was the proprietor of the Ace High Saloon.
Moore just killed Scarns.
Is that right?
Mr. Gimlin, he didn't have no choice. Scarns was about to kill him.
I need a whiskey.
Reese.
Yes, sir?
Give Moore a whiskey on the house. Scarns was a worthless peckerwood anyway.
Marshal Jarvis came running in then. His own gun was drawn, and after a quick glance around the room, he saw Scarns lying on the floor.
What happened?
I see you're a day late and a dollar short, as usual. As you can see, Scarns got himself killed.
Who did it?
What difference does it make who did it? Scarns is dead no matter who did it.
Marshal Jarvis walked over to Scarns' body and stared down at it for a moment. He kicked the body lightly, then a little bit harder. Scarns did not respond.
You're right. He's dead.
Jarvis looked around the saloon, returning everyone's curious gaze with one of his own.
So, is anyone going to tell me who did it?
I killed him.
Why?
Because it seemed like the thing to do at the time.
Go on about your business, Marshal. There's nothing for you to do here.
I'll send Ponder down for the body.
You do that. And you tell Ponder that the Ace High won't be paying for the burying. He'll have to get the money from the town.
Yeah. The town's gonna run out of money if the killing doesn't slow down.
The Ace High Saloon was one of 3 saloons, a whorehouse, a couple of dance halls, a gambling house, and half a dozen prostitute cribs that occupied an area of shady breast called Plantation Row. It was called Plantation Row because it was just the opposite of what one thought of when thinking of plantations. Plantation Row, which was really First Street, was one of 2 cross streets of the main street in town, which was called Railroad Avenue. Railroad Avenue was as inaccurately named as Plantation Row, for no railroad served the town a shady rest. The most successful of all the businesses on Plantation Row was a saloon called Pig Palace, and it was run by a man named Jacob Bramley. Bramley was a vain man who almost always dressed in black with a low-crowned black hat around which was a band of silver. He had dark, brooding eyes and a neatly trimmed Van Dyke beard. Because of his greed and corruption, Bramley was the recognized head of Plantation Row, and his saloon, though the most successful, was in appearance typical of the other 2 saloons of Plantation Row. The bar of the Pig Palace was made of pine and painted with a flat red paint. There was no brass foot railing and no cushions in the chairs. There were four women who worked the pig palace, and all four of them had been on the line for several years now. The dissipation of their profession had taken a severe toll on their looks. Just after dark on that same day, a man named Quince Calhoun walked into the Pig Palace Saloon and up to the barkeep.
Hey, what can I get you?
Whiskey, and leave the bottle.
What kind?
The cheapest.
The bartender took a bottle from beneath the counter. There was no label on the bottle, and the color was dingy and cloudy. He pulled the cork, then poured a glass.
That'll be a nickel.
God damn! This tastes like horse piss!
It's all in the way you drink it. You don't just bolt it down. This is sipping whiskey.
Sipping whiskey, you say?
Yeah, just go easy on it. You'll get it down, and it'll get you drunk, if that's all you want.
That's all I want.
Calhoun took a smaller swallow and grimaced, but got it down.
See what I mean?
As Calhoun raised his glass to take another sip of his whiskey, he saw in the mirror a man step in through the swinging batwing doors. The man was wearing a badge, and he was sure that the Star Packer had recognized him.
Who's the lawman?
His name is Jarvis. He's the city marshal.
How long has he been your marshal?
Only about a month. Why do you ask?
No reason.
In fact, Calhoun had a good reason. Calhoun was wanted for the murder of a railroad messenger up in Howard County. Jarvis had been a deputy sheriff up in Howard County at the time. Calhoun tried to avoid the marshal, but when he looked into the mirror again, he saw that Jarvis was looking at him. He also saw, by the expression on Jarvis's face, that he had recognized him.
Calhoun?
Calhoun drew his pistol and turned.
Everybody get back against the wall. If I see any of you going for your gun, I'm going...
Harry Durbin, the private security man for the saloon, came walking toward Calhoun's body carrying a smoking shotgun.
How's the marshal?
Dead.
Son of a bitch. That's what, three marshals in the last 3 months?
Yeah, something like that.
You know what? We've had three people killed in town today. That's a lot, even for Shady Rest.
The name Shady Rest was chosen specifically to appeal to the railroad officials of the Texas and Pacific when the town made an application for the railroad to pass through their community. As the application stated, passengers and settlers will opt for this shady island in the open spaces of West Texas, and that will no doubt prove to be mutually beneficial, bringing progress to our area and additional business to your railroad. We earnestly appeal to you to give our town every consideration as you choose the western route for your great railroad. Despite their sincere petition, the town was bypassed when the T&P chose to go through Van Horn some 40 miles south. Shady Rest survived, though its name took on a more sinister tone, when a newspaper in San Angelo wrote a very unflattering article about the town, under the headline, Deadliest Town in America. The community of Shady Rest, Texas, located in the shadow of El Capitan Mountain, has earned the unenviable reputation of being the deadliest town in Texas, if not in the entire United States of America. The name Shady Rest suggests a peaceful cemetery, and indeed, the population of the cemetery is growing nearly as fast as the population of the town, which seems bent upon reducing its number through almost daily murders. Shady Rest has become a town of wild saloons, debauched houses of pleasure, and disagreements too frequently settled by gunfire in the streets. It is said that the decent citizens of the town, if there be any remaining, are prisoners in their own homes.
A week later, two young men passing through the town stopped in front of the Crooked Branch Saloon. Swinging down from their horses, they patted their dusters down.
Some bitch, Pete! You're like a pure D sandstorm there.
Yeah, well, I know what will take care of it. Come on, Johnny. Let's have us that beer we've been talking about.
You ain't going to get no argument from me.
The two young men went into the saloon and stepped up to the bar. The saloon was relatively quiet, with only four men at one table and a fifth standing down at the far end of the bar. The four at the table were playing cards. The one at the end of the bar was nursing a drink. The man nursing the drink was unusual looking in that he had no hair, nor did he have eyelashes or eyebrows. His head was almost perfectly round, and it sat upon his shoulder with no perceptible neck. His skin was white, and there was so little color in his eyes that they looked almost like clear glass.
What'll it be, gents?
Pete continued to stare at the strange-looking man.
Pete, bartender asked what we'll have.
Two beers.
Two beers it is.
The bartender turned to draw the beers.
And I'll have the same.
You boys sound like you've got a thirst.
Yeah, you might say that.
Pete continued to stare at the strange-looking man.
Hey, Johnny. Hey, look at that fella. You ever seen anything that looks like him?
Shh, Pete.
Yeah, you're right. I don't have no business staring at him. But I swear, I ain't never seen anyone looks like that. Hey, mister. I don't mean to be butting in where it's none of my business, but is you born like that? Or was it some fire or something that took off all your hair? Hey, you have hair around your pecker?
Hair around his pecker.
The bartender put the beers in front of the two boys, and they each picked up one.
Hey, I'd like to buy a drink for my new friend down there.
Pete put another nickel down on the bar. The bartender picked up the nickel and put a drink in front of the man who had so caught Pete's interest.
And there you go, mister. I bought you a drink. Now that you and me's friends, then why don't you tell me, how come is it that you look like that?
I don't drink with sons of bitches like you.
The man slid the drink back toward him.
What the hell did you call us, mister?
Easy, Pete. Maybe he's just real embarrassed by how he looks, and he don't like it that you brought it up.
Pete glared at the man, but the expression on the man's face didn't change. In fact, Pete didn't know if the man's expression could change.
I just don't intend to stand here and be insulted by that hairless, glass-eyed, chalk-faced peckerwood. I'm gonna mop the floor with his sorry ass.
The hairless man smiled, or at least his mouth moved in that expressionless face into what might have been a smile. Though if it was a smile, it was certainly a smile without mirth.
You're wearing a gun, cowboy. If we're gonna fight, why don't we make it permanent?
He stepped away from the bar and turned toward Pete.
Now, wait a minute. Now, hold on. There's no need to carry things this far. This isn't worth either one of us dying over.
Oh, it won't be either of us, cowboy. It'll just be you. Well, actually, it'll be both of you. You came here together. You're gonna die together.
Now, wait a minute. Are you saying that you're willing to go up against both of us? One against two?
Well, that's not quite what I'm saying. Wade, are you up there?
Yes, sir, Mr. Foster. I'm up here.
Wade was sitting in a high chair overlooking the saloon. He was holding a rifle.
What? Now, wait a minute. That ain't right. If there's going to be two of you, you should both be down here.
There aren't two of us, cowboy.
What do you mean there ain't two of you?
Actually, there are three of us. Luke, are you following this?
Yes, sir, Mr. Foster. I'm ready.
Luke had been one of the four men sitting at the table when Pete and Johnny first came in. The other three at the table had moved out of the way, leaving only Luke. Luke was no more than 20 feet away from the two boys and to the side. He already had a pistol in his hand.
You feel better now? Luke is going to be a part of this fight, and he's down here with us.
That's 3-2. And both of them are already holding guns.
Well, they are holding guns because that's what I pay them to do. You see, I own this establishment.
No, this has gone too far now. Look, we're sorry if we offended you, but me and Pete will just be on our way now.
Oh, it's too late for that. I'm afraid you two boys have already brought this to a head.
We ain't going to draw on you. If you shoot us, it'll be in cold blood in front of all these witnesses.
What witnesses would that be?
Foster looked over toward the three men who earlier had been sitting at a table with Luke, but were now standing back against the wall.
I don't see any witnesses.
Taking their cue, the three men hurried out the front door, followed by the bartender. Pete's knees grew so weak that he could barely stand, and he felt nauseous.
Please, Mr. Foster, we don't want no trouble. Why don't you just let us apologize, and we'll go on our way.
Like I said, pull your guns.
The sheriff. How are you going to explain this to the sheriff?
Oh, the sheriff doesn't even come to Shady Rest. He says it's too dangerous for him.
Well, what about the marshal? Don't this town have a marshal?
I don't know whether we do or not. We keep killing them off, you see. Luke, do we have a marshal?
Not yet, we ain't.
Our last marshal got hisself killed down at the Pig Palace last week, remember?
Oh, yes, I do remember. Well, this is gonna work out just fine, isn't it? I don't reckon we're gonna be bothered by anyone at all. So, anytime you're ready, cowboys.
Please.
Pete, these sons of bitches are going to kill us, and there ain't nothing we can do to stop it. And I don't plan on going out like any kind of a sniveling coward. So, buck up. Let's at least go down fighting.
Pete nodded.
Yeah. Let's do it.
They started their draw. Foster walked through the cloud of gun smoke and quickly looked through the bodies of the two men. From Billy's pocket, he took a $20 gold piece and $20 in paper money. Johnny had no gold pieces, but he had $60 in cash. Foster divided the money with his men. On the afternoon of the day that the shooting occurred, the Shady Rest Merchants Association held an emergency meeting. It was attended by most of the business owners in town, though the owners of three of the four saloons were absent. So too were the owners of the dance hall and gambling house, as well as Abby Dolan, the whorehouse madam. Gerald Hawkins was there. He owned the Texas Star. The Texas Star was not to be confused with or compared to the Ace High, the Crooked Branch, or the Pig Palace. Fist fights were a daily occurrence in those saloons, and knifings and shootings happened with alarming regularity. The bar girls in those three saloons generally came from a whorehouse, the saloons being their last stop before they were no longer able to ply their profession. There was one woman present at the meeting, and that was Annabelle O'Callaghan. Annabelle was an attractive and some said feisty redhead in her mid-20s who owned the Elite Shop, a dressmaking shop in Shady Rest. Because she was a business owner, she was very active in the Shady Rest Merchants Association.
Gene, where are the bodies now?
Melton Milner was the first to speak up. Milner owned the Milner Hotel.
They are down at my place.
Gene Ponder was the undertaker.
Do you know who they are or where they came from?
Well, Foster said they called each other Pete and Johnny. Well, he never heard the last names or where they came from.
Did they have any money on them?
Roy Clinton owned the apothecary.
Oh, they didn't have one thin dime.
Which is damn hard to figure out. I mean, those boys obviously weren't from around here, which means they were traveling. And who travels with no money at all?
If they didn't have no money, who's paying for the burying?
Gary Dupree owned the Emporium.
Mayor Trout said I could sell their horses and tack. That'll be enough to pay for the burying.
That's right, I did. I got the approval of the city council.
But if we don't know who they are or where they came from, we won't be able to contact their folks to tell them what happened. That's such a shame.
George Tobin shook his head.
There'll be but two more, if more than a dozen just like them that we have in the graveyard. Unknown and unlamented.
The railroad, having bypassed Shady Rest, their only connection with the outside world was the Shady Rest to Van Horn stagecoach line. George Tobin owned that stage line.
Yes, well, that sort of brings us to the purpose of this meeting, doesn't it? Did any of you read that article in the San Angelo newspaper last week?
When no one spoke up, Hawkins pulled out the paper and read it to them. After he finished, he looked back at the others.
Deadliest town in America. Citizens, prisoners in their own homes. Is that the kind of reputation we want?
Of course not. But what's the solution? What can we do about it?
I have a suggestion as to what we can do about it. But the moment I make that suggestion, you people and everyone in town will think it is a self-serving suggestion.
I know what you are going to say, and you are right. It is what needs to be done. But you are also right. If you push closing down the other saloons, it will seem self-serving.
It wouldn't be self-serving if I pushed for it. I think we should close those saloons, the dance halls, the gambling house, the prostitute cribs, and the two houses of prostitution. What do you think, Mayor?
I don't know that the city has any right to close them. They all have business licenses and they pay their taxes on time. And where I might see closing down Abby's place, as far as Susie's dream house is concerned, well, the doc says she runs a clean house. He checks the girls regularly. Besides, Susie doesn't allow any misbehaving in her house, not even drinking.
What about the Chinaman?
What about him?
He's running a laundry. Does he have a business license?
He's using my license.
Earl Cook was the barber.
The building where he runs his laundry is right behind my barbershop, and I own it. That means my license is all he needs.
Yeah, but a laundry isn't all he runs back there. He's running an opium den, too.
Yes, but at least the men who go back there to take the pipe just lie around without bothering anyone. There haven't been any killings in the opium dens.
Mayor, when are we going to get another marshal? It's been some time now since Jarvis was killed. You know, I know, and we all know that Wash Prescott isn't up to the job. He's a pretty good deputy, but he's not a marshal.
Nor does he want to be. But there is a young man who worked as a cowboy out at the Double R Ranch who has applied for the job. I talked to Mr. Richards about him. He said he's a good man.
Who is it? I know just about all the cowboys.
His name is Devery Pruitt.
Richards is right. Pruitt is a good man, but he won't be a very effective marshal.
Why do you say that, Gerald?
Because he'll be in way over his head. He's too young and too inexperienced to be able to handle the job.
Yeah, well, Jarvis had been a deputy sheriff before. What good did his experience do him, huh?
I'm just telling you what I think. I don't believe young Pruitt will be able to handle the job.
So what are you suggesting? You think we should just give up, do you?
No, I'm not suggesting that at all. But with only Wash Prescott to help him, I'm afraid we're just setting ourselves up to get another marshal killed.
Big Rock, Colorado. As the train pulled out of the station, Matt watched the cars passing by. Most of the windows were dark because at this hour the passengers were trying to sleep. But the windows of the day cars were well lit, and here he could see the tired faces of passengers who were either unable or unwilling to pay for more comfortable accommodations. He smiled at the thought because that was exactly how he had traveled, seeing no need to take a berth for only half a night. Matt patted his horse, speared on the neck. The animal had been offloaded from the stock cars a few minutes before.
I know. You're mad at me because you couldn't ride in the same car. But believe me, Spirit, you were a lot more comfortable than I was.
Matt Jensen! It's good to see you back in Big Rock.
Hello, Mr. Tinkham. I thought I'd visit with Smoke and Sally for a while.
Well, I know they're gonna enjoy your visit. Will you be riding out there tonight?
No, I thought I'd get a room for the rest of the night and go out there tomorrow.
In that case, you'll be wanting your horse looked after.
Yes, if you don't mind.
Don't mind at all. It's always good to see you when you come to town. You just don't come often enough.
Oh, I don't ever want to make a pest of myself.
Aw, you're never a pest. At least not to anyone that knows you. I hope you have a pleasant visit.
Another ringer!
Matt was having a game of horseshoes with Cal and Pearlie.
Let me see that horseshoe. I don't think that's a real horseshoe. I think it's a magnet.
I knew it! I knew it had to be something like that for Cal to throw as many ringers as he does. He's been using magnets all this time.
It's not magnet. It's magic.
He held his hand up and wiggled his fingers.
I've got magic in this hand. Didn't you know that?
Matt's toss landed on top of Cal's.
How about that, Cal? He just canceled you out.
Yeah, well, his ringer don't count either.
Inside the house Smoke had built, Sally was just finishing up dinner. Smoke was in the parlor looking at a new stack of stereo-opticon photographs of Yellowstone National Park that Matt had brought as a gift to them.
Smoke, would you like to call the boys?
I don't think any of the three of them would appreciate being called boys, but they would appreciate being called to dinner. Have you heard anything else about the man who killed your friends? What was his name? Mutt Crowley?
Yes, his name is Mutt Crowley, and no, it's been a year since he escaped, and I haven't heard another thing about him. It still blisters my you-know-what that he didn't hang for what he did.
The word you're looking for is ass. Cal, would you pass the biscuits, please?
Yes, ma'am.
He'll turn up somewhere, Matt. People like him don't have enough sense to stay out of trouble.
The sign at the edge of town read Monotony, Kansas, population 235, Gateway to the World. The Gateway to the World referred to the fact that Monotony was a water stop on the Union Pacific Railroad, It was also a transfer point for funds being moved about by Wells Fargo, so that the small bank often had a great deal more money than anyone would suspect. Today, the bank had on deposit $12,500, a temporary holding credit until the Wells Fargo stagecoaches would take varying amounts of money from the account to deliver to those banks that weren't on the railroad. The greatest security in holding such funds lay in the secrecy of their operations. Anytime there was to be a significant transfer of funds, only the shipper and receivers of the funds were aware of the transaction, though, of course, the railroad messenger also knew. And it was the latter, the fact that the railroad messenger knew about the transfer of funds, that presented the fatal flaw in the operation. Because Dingus Perry, a railroad messenger, had recently sold the information for $100. The purchasers of the information were the Crowley brothers, Pritchard and Mutt. Mutt having joined his brother's gang shortly after Pritchard helped him escape from prison. Pritchard and Mutt, along with four other men, Bill Carter, Lenny Fletcher, Dax Williams, and Titus Carmichael, rode into the little town of Monotony at just after 9 o'clock in the morning. All six men were wearing long tan dusters, though the dusters would not raise suspicion because such dusters were routinely worn against trail dust. What was unusual was to see six men, total strangers, arrive in town at the same time. Monotony never had visitors, except during those brief moments when the trains would stop to take on water and the weary travelers at the windows would stare blankly at the lethargic scene before them.
Titus, you stay down here at this end of the street. When we leave, we'll be coming this way. I don't want to be surprised by having someone waiting down here to waylay us. Lenny, you and Dax will come into the bank with Mutt and me.
You done told us that a dozen times.
And I'll tell you a dozen more times if that's what it takes, Carter. When you undertake an operation like this, you must plan everything to perfection. You cannot afford to take any chances.
Titus dropped off as directed while the remaining five men rode on down to a small brick building with a weathered sign identifying it as the Wells Fargo Bank of Monotony. There, Pritchard, Mutt, Lenny, and Dax dismounted and handed the reins of their horses over to Bill. After looking up and down the street for a moment, Pritchard nodded at the others, and the four men went into the bank. There were two men inside, a bank teller and a customer.
Gentlemen, this is a robbery. You, sir, please step away from the counter.
As soon as the customer was out of the way, Pritchard handed a cloth bag to the teller.
You, I want you to put $12,500 in this sack.
$12,500? Mister, maybe you didn't notice, but this is a very small bank in a very small town. What makes you think we have that much money?
I don't think you have it. I know you have it. It's the Wells Fargo transfer. Now fill up that bag as I instructed.
Hey, Pritchard, Mutt! There's someone riding up this way. What if he comes in?
Dax, you idiot! Don't use our names!
Mutt turned back toward the teller.
Hurried up!
The teller dropped several bound stacks of bills into the cloth bag, then handed it over to Pritchard.
All right, we got the money. Let's go.
As Pritchard and the others started toward the door, the teller suddenly pulled a shotgun out from under the window.
He's got a gun!
The teller went down under a barrage, unable to get off one shot. Pritchard looked over at the lone customer.
I do hope you don't attempt anything like that. I assure you it would be most disastrous for you.
I don't even have a gun!
The customer held his hands in the air.
Let's go.
They rushed out of the bank and saw that Bill was engaged with someone who was standing in the middle of the street. The man was wearing a badge.
Shoot him! Shoot him!
The lawman went down. Leaping into their saddles, the horses thundered out of town. Within moments, the six riders were clear of the town and were riding hard, having made their escape. The stunned town prepared to bury their dead.
Bank robbery. Felons take thousands of dollars. Culprits said to be Crowley brothers. Monotony, Kansas. On the 15th, the streets of the small railroad town of Monotony, Kansas, rang with gunfire as six men made good their escape. Behind them, Oleg Simmons the teller and Stuart Mason the marshal lay dead of gunshot wounds. Eyewitnesses in the bank and on the street have identified two of the bank robbers as the Crowley brothers, Pritchard and Mutt. The four others with them have not been identified. Pritchard is the older of the two Crowley brothers
and unlike so many others who share his chosen profession, is a very well-educated man. He is sometimes referred to as the Bandit Professor, and is known for his precise use of the English language. Despite Pritchard Crowley's education, grammatical skills, and trappings of a gentleman, he has proven himself to be a man who is totally devoid of any redemptive qualities. He has used the gun with deadly efficiency, and is known to have killed at least 3 men prior to the recent bank robbery. Mutt Crowley, the younger of the 2 brothers, was previously convicted and sentenced to be hanged by a court in Colorado. Shortly before the hanging was to take place, however, he escaped. It is now believed, though not known for a fact, that his escape was facilitated by his brother, Pritchard.
Within a week of the robbery, wanted posters were issued. Rewards were also offered for anyone who could be proved was with the Crowley brothers during the perpetration of the bank robbery. As none of the other perpetrators were known, they weren't named, and the reward for each of them was limited to $1,500. Though only the state could issue the wanted posters, the reward money was being offered by Wells Fargo. And though the total reward money offered exceeded the amount of money stolen, it was the policy of Wells Fargo to offer large rewards for the capture of anyone who stole from them. This was done to discourage would-be robbers from targeting Wells Fargo, and for the most part, it was an effective ploy as Wells Fargo shipments were much less frequently robbed than other banks and money transfer agencies. Initially, however, circulation of the reward posters was limited to within the borders of the state of Kansas. When Pritchard made the division of the money, he and Mutt took $2,500 apiece, and he gave each of the other 4 men $1,875 each.
I think me and you should get $3,000 each and let the others divide up what's left.
No. As long as everything is kept on the up and up, we will forever have the loyalty of those who ride with us. And in this business, loyalty of the men who ride with you is the most valuable commodity.
Pritchard tended to think and talk in a way that Mutt often found difficult to comprehend. That was because Mutt had spent 5 years in the state penitentiary at Canyon City, Colorado, while Pritchard had spent 4 years at the University of Colorado. When he graduated with a Bachelor of Arts degree, he took a job as an assistant professor of English in a small college in Wyoming. It was there that Pritchard had discovered the dark side of himself, a side that he could not control. He lured a pretty young freshman into his office one night with the offer to provide private tutorship. There, he raped and murdered her. Then, he left her body on the side of a lake. The murder of the young girl remained a mystery, and Pritchard was never suspected. When the bodies of 2 more young women were found, the town became panicked at the thought of a crazed killer and despoiler of young women. And because the last 2 women were not college students, no connection was made that could lead anyone to suspect young, handsome Professor Pritchard Crowley. After only 1 year of teaching in the university, Pritchard left the school and got a job in the Denver Loan and Trust Bank. It was the trust part that did him in, because less than 3 months into the job, he decided to augment his salary by embezzling $15,000. From that moment on, Pritchard was on the outlaw trail. Annabelle wasn't a member of the city council, but as a representative of the Merchants Association, she was able to sit in on the meetings, and she was present on the day Devery Pruitt was sworn in as the new town marshal.
You have quite a job cut out for you, Marshal Pruitt. Conditions over on Plantation Row are practically out of hand now.
Not practically out of hand. They are out of hand.
The tactless side of me would say that Plantation Row has been very good for my business, though since the last 7 burials have been at the expense of the town, I have to say I'm not making that much out of it.
Yes, paid for by the town, and that is beginning to be quite a problem. Our tax base is barely able to keep up with the expenses of all these burials.
There's a possible solution to our problem.
What?
Supposing we charge the businesses that are down in Plantation Row a special tax. A tax higher than we charge any other business in town. Now that'll do 2 things. It'll help pay the cost of all the burials, and it might even be so burdensome to them as to make them shut down.
Mr. Dempster, you're the city attorney. Can we charge them an extra tax?
Well, we could charge an excise tax on the sale of liquor, gambling, and whoring, but if it is challenged, the state might not allow it, especially if it is applied only to Plantation Row, which it would have to be, otherwise Gerald Hawkins would have to pay it as well, and he hasn't really given us any trouble.
He doesn't have whores in his place.
No, but I do sell liquor, and while I didn't used to have gambling, I do now, ever since Emerson Culpepper arrived.
Maybe we can find some way to exempt you from the excise tax.
I don't see how. If you charge the people on Plantation Row an excise tax, Mr. Dempster's right. You're going to have to charge me as well.
Well, I have a suggestion. We don't have a courthouse, and the few times we've had a trial, we've had to find a place to hold them. Suppose the city were to lease the Texas Star Saloon to serve as a courthouse when needed, and the lease payment will exactly equal the excise tax. That way, it will be a wash.
Mm-hmm. What do you say, Mr. Hawkins? Would you be willing to rent your place to the city for special occasions?
I would be honored to do so.
Shortly after the meeting of the city council, Jacob Bramley, in the far end of town, called a meeting of the other businessmen and women of Plantation Row. Fred Foster was there for the Crooked Branch, so was Red Gimlin from the Ace High. There was also a representative from the dance hall and one from the gambling house. Abby Dolan of Abby's Place was there, too. Abby weighed about 250 pounds, and she sat there smoking a cigar and fanning herself, her frizzy blonde hair sticking out in all directions.
What do you call a meeting for, Jacob?
I called this meeting to discuss the excise tax the city has placed on us.
Yeah, what are we going to do about that?
There's not much we can do but pay it.
I think the time has come for us to organize.
Organize what?
Organize ourselves. The town of Shady Rest has a city council, and it has a merchants association, but neither one of them meet our needs. And let's face it, this excise tax is just a start. You know damn well if they could find a way to close us down, they would.
Well, how are they going to do that? We have licenses, we pay municipal taxes, we are legal.
About those excise taxes, I don't think that's anything to worry about. I don't think any of the merchants of the town will put up with having their taxes raised.
They won't be getting their taxes raised, just the businesses on Plantation Row.
What? How can they do that?
Because the new taxes will be applied only to the sale of liquor, to gambling, and to whoring. And that gets all of us.
All right. What do you propose we do to stop them?
At the moment, I don't have any idea. That's why I called this meeting. I think that if we organized ourselves, maybe into something like the Plantation Row Citizens Betterment Council, we might be able to come up with a way to fight it. But for now, the most important thing for us to do is to form the council.
All right, I'm in.
Me too. Count me in as well. Who's going to be the head of it?
Bramley thought of it. I say it should be him.
So do I. All right, Bramley, you're the man. So, come up with something.
I'll work on it. I'll have a suggestion next time we meet.
Mitt Crowley did not come to Shady Rest alone. Bill Carter and Lenny Fletcher had come with him. Since the bank robbery in Monotony, Kansas, they had spent their money on expensive food and liquor, expensive whores, and even more expensive games of chance. When they arrived in Shady Rest, they were down to just a couple hundred dollars each. They were spending almost all their time in one saloon or another. At first, they split their time among three of the four saloons in town, generally avoiding the Texas Star. They had tried the Texas Star, but the problem, as far as Crowley, Fletcher, and Carter were concerned, was that the women were bar girls only. They would drink and provide company for the men, but they let it be known from the outset that they weren't prostitutes, and no amount of money any of the three men offered them would make them change their minds. Mutt Crowley was well aware that he was a wanted man, so when he arrived in Shady Rest, he took the name of Dale Morgan. Bill Carter and Lenny Fletcher, who had not been identified for their parts in the Kansas bank robbery and murders, did not find it necessary to change their names. The fact that the bar girls at the Texas Star weren't prostitutes wasn't the only reason the three men no longer frequented the Texas Star. They hadn't been barred from coming back, but none of the women and very few of the patrons would have anything to do with them. Now they spent all their time on Plantation Row, and though they did occasionally visit the Crooked Branch and Ace High, the Pig Palace had become their saloon of choice. Because they had been warned by Pritchard to stay out of trouble, the three men did nothing to raise anyone's suspicions. However, the very fact that they did nothing is what did raise the suspicions of many. Mayor Trout was not only a supporter of Annabelle's right to belong to the Shady Rest Merchants Association, his wife was also one of Annabelle's best customers. The mayor planned to attend an upcoming political conference at the state capitol in Austin, and that meant a formal ball. Despite the fact that she had a closet full of dresses and fancy gowns, Lillian Trout insisted that she had nothing to wear. So she came to the elite shop to ask Annabelle if she could do something to alleviate her desperate, bereft situation.
Why, of course, Mrs. Trout. I'll do whatever I can for you. What seems to be the trouble?
I want you to sew for me the most beautiful gown you've ever made. Everyone in Austin is so snooty. I'm sure they think that anyone who doesn't live in Austin must wear dresses made of flower sacks.
It will be the most beautiful, and I can't think of anyone more beautiful to wear it.
Oh, cost is not a consideration.
After the bank robbery, the Crowley gang had left Kansas and gone to California, where they'd spent nearly all of their money. Then they'd left California for Texas. Mutt decided to go to Shady Rest while Pritchard chose Pecos, which wasn't too far away. Pritchard and Mutt also took on assumed names. Mutt would call himself Dale Morgan, and Pritchard would adopt the name Abe Connor. That way, they would be able to keep in touch with each other. When Pritchard Crowley rode into Pecos, Texas, he found it to be full of activity and, like ants at a picnic, cowboys were everywhere. He reined up in front of a saloon, but as he dismounted, he didn't notice that a young cowboy was crossing the street right behind him. His dismount caused the cowboy to have to step away, and when he did, he stepped directly into a pile of horse dropping. There was a young woman who was crossing the street with him, and she managed to avoid it.
Hey, mister, look what you just made me do!
You have my apologies, sir. It was unintentional.
Yeah? Well, your apology ain't good enough.
The young cowboy held his soiled boot out.
Get down there and clean it off.
The girl with the cowboy saw the danger in Pritchard's eyes before the cowboy did, and she reacted to it by pulling on his arm.
Come on, Teddy. Don't make such a stink over it. Let's go. I'll clean your boot for you. There's only a little on it anyway.
No, this saddle tramp is the one who messed up my boot. He's the one who's going to clean it off.
Pritchard ignored the young man and just tied his horse off at the hitching rail.
Maybe you didn't hear me, mister. I'm talking to you.
Pritchard stared directly at the young cowboy.
Young man, you are beginning to grow tiresome. You would be well advised to take the young lady's advice and let this issue drop.
You would like that, wouldn't you? You are a coward and you want me to just go away. Well, I'm not going away. I'm calling you out.
Are you now? Are you that anxious to die?
No, wait! Teddy, please, let it be.
Young lady, if you and your young man will just walk away, this will be all over.
Don't be talking to my sister. She ain't the one you gotta worry about. I am.
You mean the young lady is your sister?
Yeah. Not that it's any of your business.
Evidently, your sister is the only one in your family who has any sense. You had better listen to her, Sonny.
Don't call me Sonny, you son of a bitch!
Teddy reached down to put his hand on the butt of his pistol.
Now I'm gonna give you one last chance. I'm gonna count to three. You either apologize and clean off my boot, or go for your gun. I don't care which.
Teddy, no!
Lucy, you get on out of the way.
Teddy, please!
Miss Lucy, you better get on over here. It don't look like Teddy's gonna back down.
Teddy, I beg of you!
The man who had spoken took hold of Lucy and pulled her out of harm's way.
What's it gonna be, mister? Are you gonna clean off my boot, or do I start counting?
I've already apologized, and I shall do so again. But I've no intention of cleaning your boot. So if that is the only thing that can interrupt this danse de la mort, then I suggest you start counting.
One, two, three!
Teddy dropped his gun, then fell back onto the boardwalk. Lucy pulled away from the person who tried to hold her back and rushed to her brother's side.
Miss, I'm very sorry about all this. I want it well understood that I did all I could to avoid this fight.
What's your name, mister?
The name is Connor. Abe Connor.
Pritchard put his pistol in his holster, then walked to the Silver Spur Saloon.